Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Scott Keith, and by our friend, Phil Bartelt. Phil joined us on the last episode of the Thinking Fellows on Donatism. If you have not listened to that, I highly suggest it. I think it came out very well. Phil was able to flex his knowledge of heresy in the early church on us pretty well there. It was great. He definitely showed his ability to research and then spit it back out. So I think that was good. Phil is a member of the Junior Fellowship at 1517. We have had fellowship, junior fellowship, and senior fellows for a while, but recently, over the last couple of months, we made that public on our website. We sort of identified who the Thinking Fellowship at 1517 is, and part of that is it gave us a means of organizing the ways that those people contribute so that you can go see what they do. So if you would like to see the articles that Phil has written, and in fact now the Thinking Fellows episodes that he has showed up on will pop up there as well, you can do that. You can go to 1517.org. In the drop-down menu, there's a contributors tab, and when you get that, you'll see all the different sections of fellows and contributors for our website. If you want to see what Phil has done, you can go and you can hit Junior Fellows, and he's in the list of, I think, there's four or five of us in there. Four of us. Yeah. So
Hoyam, Kelsey, you, me.
I felt like there was somebody else.
Hoyam is bidding for advancement, though.
Hoyam is bidding for advancement. He's probably, once he's got that PhD, there's probably no reason not to give it to him.
Yeah,
probably. Yeah. So
we'll see. We'll make him come and grovel.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, Phil, you wanted, I know people who listened to the last episode heard you, but you want to give a brief introduction to yourself?
Yeah. Philip Bartelt, junior fellow, as Caleb said, and I'm glad that of the junior fellows that I'm in charge of the heresy department.
Oh, that's good.
that makes my heart glad. A graduate of Concordia University, Irvine, born and raised LCMS, and currently attending Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. Just finished my third year of seminary, which was vicarage. It's kind of like student teaching for pastors. So I was in Raleigh, North Carolina. Finally back in Indiana to finish up my last year of seminary. So hopefully in 9 months or so, I'll be ordained.
Yeah, you'll receive a call and you'll be ordained and you'll end up at a church.
Have that indelible character.
Ooh, no.
That is a joke. That is totally
go
a joke.
Go listen to the last episode.
To do that because you'd be surprised the number of people that just do not have a sense of humor.
I say that with a massive smile and knowing that I'm the farthest thing from indelible. So.
That's great. Well, before we move on to today's topic, if you enjoy the Thinking Fellows, if you're a new listener, you can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of the podcasts that 1517 produces. And while you're there on the website, you can go ahead and hop around and you can see the rest of the resources we have. We host everything from a handful of different blogs, like the 1517 blog, the Christ Hold Fast blog, which does a lot of cultural topics. And we also have the Craft of Preaching, which if your pastor follows the lectionary and you can see the readings and you can see the way certain seminary professors and teachers are handling those readings, and it can maybe help you prepare a sermon. They do not write sermons there at the Craft of Preaching. Mm-hmm. They try to help people be encouraged to read the text and to read the texts with somebody else. And I get a lot of feedback that is been a valuable resource for pastors who are in parishes, writing a lot, and have been doing so sort of alone for a while and now feel like they can bounce ideas off of somebody else.
Craft of Preaching was something I actually used over vicarage. I was preaching every week during Advent, Epiphany, and Lent, and once every month on top of that on Sundays, and it was enormously helpful.
That's good.
It was really, really cool, especially the video discussions on the gospel text. Here, four pastors or three pastors kicking ideas around. It was really, really helpful.
Yeah, I think it really has been, I think, one of the most vocally well-received things we do. And so if you haven't checked that out yet, 1517.org/craft of preaching, or if you just go to the website, it's pretty easy to navigate to the stuff over there. So for today's topic, I thought we would finally kick off what I've been talking about for a couple episodes now, which is potentially going back to a rhythm on the Thinking Fellows. Where we do episodes that are intertwined or related for a month, 2 months in a row. So you're talking about 5 to 8 episodes potentially to do that. And I thought we'd go back to our roots a little bit. You know, when we started the Thinking Fellows, we started doing just common topics of theology, Loci, using Melanchthon's 1521 Loci, because, you know, we got fanboys of Melanchthon here over at Thinking Fellows. And so we just started with the basics of Christian doctrine. Now, one of the hard things is when you've done that, you sort of feel like it's been done, right? When you want to go back to a topic. So if, you know, if we just do an episode, say, on the Holy Spirit or something, which is an episode I'd be interested in doing. Honestly, I like talking about the Holy Spirit.
Third article.
I go there and I type, we record this episode and I type it in our list as I'm doing it. And I type in the words Holy Spirit for the episode title. And it goes, that title's already been used. And you kind of feel like, did we need to do that? And I've found by talking to listeners, by seeing people's emails, that yes, it's been 5 years. You know, people remember those episodes that we do, but not everybody's going to go back, and not everybody should go back and re-listen to us talk about the same thing three times. We can revisit those. Yes, it'll be similar because our confessions about doctrine haven't changed over the last couple of years. Those have stayed the same, but it'll also include things we've learned over the last 5 years, maybe conversations and stories we've had. And so while we can do those same things, it certainly will come out different. And sort of my fear that it's repetitive doesn't have to be there. And so the angle, instead of chasing the Loci or following the Loci this time, that I want to do is I want to peg down those doctrines which sort of brought the controversy of Lutheranism to a bubble in the early, in 15 teens, right? In the 15 teens, what's getting Lutherans in trouble? Why are the doctrines that they're teaching and debating causing more debates, causing for them to be drawn in front of councils and courts? And so really I want to do what leads up to the Lutherans having to give a confession of faith in 1530. What are the doctrines that lead us to 1530 from 1517, from our origin date to there? And so there's a couple things to talk about, and I think this episode is a good history and context to start with, to say how did the ideas and the doctrines first start getting disseminated or talked about if it wasn't in the form of a confession?
It's kind of interesting to, I assume you'll air the episode we just recorded before this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, one of the doctrines that is a controversy a little bit already by the writing of the Augsburg Confession in 1530 is the indelible character of the priesthood.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, whether or not in order to be a pastor, you have to have sort of this indelible character. How do you describe that, Phil? Adam Francisco's brother calls it the magic fairy wand at ordination. That at ordination, you know, it bestows something on you that is different than sort of what everyone else has within the priesthood of all believers. And that, in fact, they would deny the priesthood of all believers at that time, Rome would. But that you are different, and that difference is what makes it so that you can be a priest and an intercessor between God and normal people.
Yeah, you're a, for those who believe in this, and I don't. So for Rome, and for those who confess an indelible character, it really does make you a different class of person.
Right.
You are a
priestly class.
Yeah, it is the priestly caste, the class of priesthood. So, and you are holy. You can do special things, wear special garments, perform special tasks. And even amongst the clergy, though, there are certain acts or rites that a regular priest could not do, and that only bishops can do, the rite of confirmation being one of them. Historically, that was something that only bishops could do, the training and raising of the catechumenate. So even amongst the clergy, there are ranks and degrees of holiness, if you can put it that way, that you are a special person, made special by God to do special things. And another word for special would just be holy. That's our church of the word.
Set apart.
Set apart, yeah. You're set apart for these special things. And unfortunately, because we say holy or special or unique, set apart, this also tends to ring in people's mind as better.
Better, yeah.
Yeah. It's not just different. It's better.
It's hard sometimes to escape. Even in the minds of those people that are called holy.
Well, and it's hard to escape better when it comes to holy, because that is a status before God of cleanliness, of set apartness, of being acceptable, that when the label of holy is not there, that level of acceptable isn't there. And so really being acceptable to God is better than not being being that, or dedicated to God, or whatever word you want to use there in that place. There is a betterness if somebody has something for in the, or going for the relationship with God that you don't have. He is God, after all.
Yep.
Yeah. So we have that going on. We have some of the low-hanging fruit, right? Like the one that, like, people are like, say it, justification, right?
Yeah.
This is an issue that is going to lead up, you know, a lot of Luther scholarship for a while was concerned with finding the shift. When did it go from?
Yeah. And if you're talking about what led to the writing of the Augsburg Confession, you have to sort of see that the Augsburg Confession is written for Article 4, I think. You know, you get, which is the article on justification, the article upon which the church stands or falls. And so that's the big one.
That's a big one. So justification and righteousness are continually argued from the early Reformation forward. You have other issues like grace. Grace is one where the reformers, the way that they talk and label grace is different than the Roman Catholic Church, right, and is argued
against.
Well, and
if we're talking about timeline here, I'd be with Lowell on Lowell Green's side, which is a big surprise, saying that this is first used by Melanchthon in 1519 in his baccalaureate thesis for his, essentially, the degree that Phil's going to get this year, which is back then would have been his Bachelor's of Divinity. Now we, because of the modern American system, call it a Master's of Divinity. Interesting note, though, Rod Rosenblatt's degree out of seminary was a Bachelor of Divinity degree that I think some years later transmuted into a Master's of Divinity. I think he tells the story that they asked him if he wanted it. He said, no, I don't care. And it just showed up in the mail anyway. Which I think is kind of funny. Nice. So most of the older pastors who went to seminary would have received a Bachelor's of Divinity degree that when the system changed, they sort of got in the mail a different diploma.
That's kind of a great, yeah. I kind of wish.
It's kind of like if you go to Oxford, like if you graduate from Oxford with a bachelor's degree and you don't go to jail and, you know, you're sort of a person in good standing. I think it's after 2 years that bachelor's degree is turned into a master's degree. Under the idea that you worked so hard at Oxford that you really earned a master's degree. We just had to see if you were worth it after the degree.
I would be really happy if, like, I, you know, one day I go check my mailbox and from CUI is a congratulations, you've been upgraded to master's.
I always degree. Feel like they should have done that for me, but they didn't. So we won't dwell on it.
You went to seminary afterwards. We'll upgrade you.
Yeah, but in his baccalaureate thesis is the first time, you know, in the Reformation. You can't say the first time because you'd have to take Apostle Paul out of that, and I'm sure some church fathers
Augustine.
The word imputed is used to describe your righteousness before God upon justification instead of infused. And we did a little bit of that on the Norway show, which would be two episodes before this one airs, I think.
We did do a little bit of that on there. So that's one of those contested issues that gets brought against them.
See, I can be a nerd too, guys.
Yeah, this is good.
Wow.
Free will, interestingly enough, already an issue by this early, is an issue 6 months after the 95 Theses. In the Heidelberg Disputation, starts Luther's sort of kick against free will. Melanchthon joins him for a little bit and then sort of starts leaning more towards team free will later in his life.
Yeah. The order of the
pull
first.
Pull the knife out of my heart.
No, I'm just kidding. I actually, you can ask Phil. I defend Melanchthon's propositions on the bound will quite a bit, and some, and
I think there's some, this is a sidebar, I think there are some conversations that I'd like to have with Steve Paulson on this, because what Melanchthon basically, he's never on the side of free will when it comes to God.
No,
never on that side, but he does think that Luther treads towards Manichaeism in the bondage of the will, which is like an absolute determinism, right? Yeah. Think of it as everything's determined.
Which is funny because Melanchthon, when he talks about history,
zero choices.
Which I also think is funny because if you read Melanchthon on history, like in sort of his more, you know, educational works, he's very determinist when it comes to human history. He talks about sort of
he thinks
God,
it's all God's plan.
Yeah,
and
he's really the first, shaping it.
He's the first person to do sort of, at least in, can we call this modern times? Modern, quote unquote, modern times, to do an extensive history of the world.
Yeah.
Which is, it just shows you how arrogant these guys are. I'm sorry. I love them. And they know so much more than we will. But he's like, he sits down to write an entire history of the world.
And all from the perspective of how God
brought. This
is like
Will Durant stuff here.
And all how God used that to bring certain eras to be like Christ. And then specifically the Reformation. How like this is literally God led history to Wittenberg.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like Hegel too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're real German.
Yeah,
there's that.
Yeah. The funny there's just some, even his astrology, even like I made this a show about Melanchthon that fast.
Yes, you did.
even Melanchthon's astrology is not like we do it now, where it's like what are the stars telling you about what's going to happen with your day? Yeah. It's him believing that if God created the stars and has given us sort of a record of his creation in the stars, we should be able to study them and to...
It's actually more like astronomy today.
Understand something about what God has done from the stars.
Which, you know, sort of like cosmological science is much closer in the idea where you try to date stars, distance. Does that have any meaning or purpose to humanity that we can observe?
Now, I still think that's a little bonky. But at the same time... you know, it's not when I always want to punch Jim Nestigan when he makes fun of it, as though he's like some sort of palm reader who also does astrology on the side. This is not what he's doing.
Well, Jim has that one instance of Melanchthon won't go in the ocean, right?
Which is, I don't think is correct. I would have to find where I read it. This is when Melanchthon was offered sort of the dean of theology at Cambridge University by Henry VIII. And, he doesn't take it. Now, Jim says he doesn't take it because he had a dream that he would die crossing an ocean. I remember reading that he didn't take it because the elector wouldn't let him take it.
Oh. Maybe the elector wouldn't, and then he came up with the dream excuse later.
Yeah, maybe he's got the elector's back, like a good soldier.
Also, when I think of like astrology and all these other things, I think of like horoscopes.
Yeah.
Like I'm a Capricorn.
Brittany,
therefore.
You're such a spaz because you're such a Pisces.
Yeah. This is not what he's doing.
That's what I think of. So.
Okay. So we got on Melanchthon, which I have a hard time pumping the brakes on because I like talking about Melanchthon. But we got there talking about the will, bound will and free will. That's an issue. That comes to a head in 1525. So that's still before the Augsburg Confession. So this is a big issue.
Yeah. Well, and related to the freedom or bondage of the will is also kind of underlying that what we have in Augustana 2, the question of original sin. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a subset of that. What do we confess about that? And Pelagianism or semi-Pelagianism, as Luther later talks about it. So that's also kind of an underlying issue with that.
What else do we have? We have the natures of the law and the gospel and command and promise and the relationship there and sort of the differentiation between a command or the issue. Eck hurls this against Luther and Melanchthon in his 404 theses in 1530. He says, you fools believe that God would command something that you can't do. And Luther and Melanchthon go, yes.
Yeah. yes.
That is correct.
Yes. So that's an issue that actually comes up quite a few handful of
you
times.
You fools, almost the opposite. You fools believe that God would ever command something you could do.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that's an issue. So the nature and the purpose of the law gets hammered out.
Question of the new obedience. What's the relationship between faith and works?
Yeah, good works gets hammered out. Quite a few times you have that gets hammered out in Heidelberg. Does it Leipzig? Yes or no, Phil?
The new obedience,
not as much.
Not really. No.
You have against Latimus, where that's really.
That all of your works, including your good ones, are sinful.
Yep. Yeah. The antinomian disputations.
Really hard there. Yeah.
Really hard there. It gets hammered out in the Augsburg Confession, and then really.
Yeah.
really well out in the apology, so that's later. But
yeah, there's a 1535 disputation that's actually on faith and works that I think Luther prepared it, but it was for a student's doctoral degree.
So this is what's interesting about this is you see that one of the reasons I wanted to do a series on this is there's an increasing trend that I've noticed to distance the disputations and the debates of early Lutheranism from the confessions, and often to say, but we don't, Heidelberg disputation's good, or sometimes I'll hear people say, not so great, and that's why we don't confess it, or thank goodness we don't confess it, or you say this about any disputation, I like Heidelberg, so I'm just going to use that, right?
Yeah.
So you get this, but it's sort of ignorant of the fact that those documents weren't written as confessional documents, and actually, the confessional documents are written to defend the ideas that are forged there in those earlier years. They are called to Augsburg. Luther's called to Worms for reasons, right? And that is those writings. And when they're asked to recant of statements like, every good deed is a sin, what does Luther say? I won't recant of this. I can't recant of this.
Yeah.
What does Melanchthon say when he's writing Augsburg Confession? Oh, we're gonna undo this a little bit. Anytime he has an inkling, he's like, maybe we should give in a little bit on good works. Luther writes him a letter that is like, don't you crack, dude.
Yeah.
I know I'm not there, but don't you crack. He's like, what if they kill us, Luther? He's like, then you die. Then you die, Melanchthon. You write what you know is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they do that. So in the confessions, they defend what they know is true, which are these propositions from the earlier years.
Yeah.
So to sort of pit, say, Augsburg or the Apology, or even let's go into 1580 and pit the formula against the early disputations is sort of the wrong mindset to have.
Yeah. Well, this since you guys get to fanboy about Melanchthon, I'm going to fanboy for a hot second about my favorite theologian, Oswald Beyer. A modern theologian, actually still alive, which is rare when you're doing theology. German guy, and he, in doing Lutheran theology, kind of specializes in this, actually. He intentionally seeks out prefaces to different works and disputations and stanzas of hymns and catechisms and other little smaller works as opposed to the big ones that most people naturally think of. And he does this actually in the spirit of the Formula of Concord. It's one of my favorites of the confessional documents, particularly on Article 8. There's this really wonderful line at the very beginning of it. He's talking about this, the person of Christ, and he say that what Luther says about the sacrament and the person of Christ is all true. And in fact, we affirm all of Luther's doctrinal and polemical writings on the supper as we do and publicly commit to the rest of them.
Yeah.
that all of his doctrinal and polemical writings, we affirm, and we are all about them because this is true Lutheran theology. And we're just riffing on what Luther has said.
And in addition to that, you have, you know, in Article 3 at the end of the Solid Declaration, there's a line.
They include like a bondage of the will and other,
this
and
one's like
Galatians commentary.
To see more on this, see the most extravagant, wonderful, beautiful work ever written on the subject, and we wholly recommend without any reservation Martin Luther.
We just couldn't get it past the full committee,
right?
And if you've ever been to a voters meeting at a Lutheran congregation,
you know
what
why.
They mean.
And so
unanimous decisions don't exist there.
So you actually have this idea where if we are debating issues in the confessions today, and you have a question about what's the context or where can we go to see what is being argued for or against earlier or outside of these, you actually do have to step backwards to the documents that come before them, because you have the issues that brought them to a head here.
Yeah. Well, one of the funny ones, you guys were talking about the Leipzig debate before I think Phil said he just wrote a blog on it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's in 1519. Was it July, Phil? I think it's July.
Yes, it was June and July.
No air conditioning, dude. No wonder they were angry.
No air conditioning, and it lasted for almost 2 or 3 weeks.
And then Caleb was saying Melanchthon was there, and I was like, yeah, he was there as he's like a research assistant.
Yeah, he was like, I don't know if this is 100% true, but I remember reading that I think this is the first bait that Melanchthon sees Luther do.
Yeah. So the big players, though, of course, are Martin Luther, and then Karlstadt is there as well. Yeah. But Luther brings along Melanchthon and another guy that's hanging around Wittenberg at that time named Nicholas von Amsdorf, which is hilarious because not too long after this, well, Melanchthon's only, if this is July of 1519, Melanchthon's been at the University of Wittenberg less than a year now.
He's a whippersnapper.
He comes in August of 1518. To the university to teach Greek.
He's 22 or something like that?
Yeah, to teach, right around there, to teach Greek.
And he's younger than Phil and I are now.
Yeah, and it's just like he's blowing the socks off of Luther, so they bring him along.
Yo, Luther's like, yo, come see this.
He's like a research assistant at this
thing. Come take notes.
But things that lead up to, you know, confessions and controversies, Melanchthon and Amsdorf get in like a years long fight over the idea of are good works necessary. Whereas Amsdorf eventually says, and if you want to read anything on this, there's both an article by Bob Kolb and Bob Kolb's dissertation, which is, I think CPH just sort of republished last year, where is on Nicholas von Amsdorf. But the article is that he titles is the line that Amsdorf used while preaching, which said good works are detrimental to salvation.
Yeah.
And so this is like a fight between two of Luther's guys.
Yeah.
And Luther, you know, is asked to weigh in on it. And he actually comes in, like officially in some letters, comes in on the side of Melanchthon saying, yeah, you know, good works are necessary. It was, which you see in the Augsburg Confession, right?
Yeah.
Way into the Augsburg Confession in a way. But Melanchthon, in order to win the fight, doubles down, which is why you get what I think is one of the worst things he ever said in the 1535 Loci, where he says good works are necessary to salvation, which sort of takes some Aristotelian playing with to explain, which was what caused the the broadly read Lutheran historian Bente, who writes the historical introduction of the Book of Concord, to call him a synergist, because he's saying, listen, if you're saying good works are necessary to salvation, you're saying good works contribute to salvation, thus you're a synergist. But Luther solves this with these guys and with the lady basically by writing the Small Catechism. is his response to this debate. He says, you know, we have to have a way in which we can teach the people good, not only life and salvation, but the Christian life, i.e., you know, what part good works play. And he gives them the Small Catechism as, and now that's not the only reason, but this is part of writing the Small Catechism, is to teach this. And it's just, to think of the Reformation, especially the early Reformation, as, you know, a group of people who are always on the same side fighting against the Roman Catholics is just not the case. Leipzig debate, Melanchthon and Nicholas von Amsdorf were there not too long after this. These two were in a knockdown dragout that lasts for years.
Mm-hmm. Well, then Luther ends up scolding Karlstadt for leading a more radical reformation than he would have done himself. Right. He has to come back to Wittenberg to kind of correct things.
Even though the movie shows him correcting Melanchthon.
Interesting. Yeah. Sure, but I mean, that's the whole reason for his famous Invocavit sermons, where he says, these are the things of the faith.
And Melanchthon's like, I'm only 22.
I didn't do anything. All this kind of, you know, the importance of studying these debates and recognizing that not everybody's on the same side or always uniform in their own opinion. It reminds me of something that one of my favorite profs at the SEM says, that when people try to ask, well, where is the reformational turn in Luther?
Yeah, that's difficult.
This is a popular question, but an enormously difficult question. And the way that this prof answered it, I really like, because the reformational turn happens when Luther's studying, when he's preparing for lecture, when he's writing debates, when he's doing all these things. It really happens in his office.
Well, it's like, if you've ever changed your mind on something, which if you haven't done it, I'd recommend it. Most people act like, you know, a lot of people act like they never have. But if you've ever changed your mind on something, nailing down exactly the moment that you change your mind on it is difficult.
Right.
Unless there was like a big catastrophic, life-changing event that precipitated you changing your mind. Most times you sort of change your mind on something over a period of time.
Or it becomes more clear.
Like you were really hardcore on this and you started to get, no exceptions. This is always wrong no matter what. And you started, you ran across a really hyperbolic exception at one point. You're like, oh gosh, that's really challenging my no exceptions. And then down the line, and maybe, I would say having been a quote unquote theologian younger and a quote unquote theologian a little older, not everything is as cut and dry to me now as it was when I was 25.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Maybe it should be, and maybe that makes me wrong on those things, but it just isn't.
No, and even, I look back at some of the things that I wrote and said, even at Concordia Irvine.
Cringe, throw some of my papers
away.
Yeah,
I just, I'm just like, oh, that's so, why did I say it? Oh.
Who gave me a 97 on that?
Well, you thought you were right.
Yeah.
And you made an argument, and mostly you get grades for the arguments that you make, not the conclusion.
Yeah. So, there's also a tendency or a habit amongst Luther scholars to divvy up parts of Luther's life. This is young Luther or middle or old.
I think that trend's finally starting to fade a little bit.
I hope it dies because I don't think you have really a 180 on anything really. Well, I think you just increase clarity.
Well, and it actually is. It's not that it's not helpful to study Luther in various ages of his life in the context of those particular historical segments. What has happened, though, is that you get Luther against the Lutherans or Luther against Luther in a way where it's literally like you pin the man against himself and you pin the man against the confessions that he subscribes to and the rest of the people who do. And it just in a way that makes it so that you can prove one point where it's like, well, he was wrong earlier. We side with this version of him. Yeah. And so it's a little schizophrenic and it actually makes what is a very helpful exercise to say, were the style of arguments different in the 15 teens than they were in 1530? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're learning too.
Yeah.
It's just, material is becoming more available to them. Their libraries expand. Their base of knowledge expands. They keep reading throughout their life. It's not like they get their degrees and they stop reading. Like Phil said, they prepare for classes that they're teaching. I mean, if you've ever prepared to teach a semesters-long university class that you haven't taught before, there's a lot that goes into that first time you teach it. And a lot of that is just research and reading.
Well, theologies on other sides pop up. So in the beginning, you're just arguing with Rome. All of a sudden, Zwingli's knocking at your door.
Yeah, now you're arguing with the enthusiasts, and then you're arguing with the Calvinists.
And now you're fighting a war on all fronts.
And sometimes you're fighting a literal war.
Yeah.
And so, which causes, sort of like the Donatist conversation to happen all over again.
There you go.
That's a Chaldic word. Were you a faithful... Fallacious. Were you faithful and did you resist or did you, like Melanchthon, give in? Who's pure? Are you Gnasio Lutheran, a real Lutheran, or are you a Philippist, one of those traitors? This conversation happens all over again.
That's true. So
we got some doctrines laid out, which is good. We'll go forward with them on that. We got some context out that we can probably dive in deeper to later too. I mean, we can define disputations for people who don't know are sort of the the outlines to scholastic debates, right? They're
the disputatio.
Yeah, they take sometimes they're point counterpoint, sometimes they're interlinked points.
Very formal. Yeah. We wouldn't. I guess maybe if you've been on a debate team, you might recognize it. But just in normal everyday conversation, we wouldn't recognize the formality of a disputation.
Right. They knew essentially the argument that the person was going to make. Then they had their own list formed.
And I've said before, if you wanted to get sort of a flavor of this, read the first, it's probably pagination wise, 2/3 of The Bondage of the Will is a more formal sort of scholastic dialectic disputational type writing.
If you want a really simple version of this, you can buy my translation of the Heidelberg Disputation from shop.1517.org.
Some shameless self-promotion.
Let's sell a couple books if we can here. You can read Phil's blog on the Leipzig debate to get a flavor of why that's important and how those debates get argued out.
I also wrote one on Anselm of Canterbury. I mean, he, as far as scholastic methodology, He's one of the grandfathers of that.
Sure is.
The point, counterpoint, really strict use of reason.
Right.
Trying to explore the things of the faith. He's the one that coins the idea of faith seeking or faith seeking understanding. Yeah. He's kind of the guy for that.
I just listened to Steve Paulson on that.
Rip it apart.
He doesn't really appreciate that phrase all that much.
No. There's
That's Outlaw God episode 7, I believe, if you want to check
that out. Which makes a lot of sense, I mean, for other things, like when it comes to some of the discussions on atonement and everything.
Yep. So as we move forward in this series, I'm going to do basically episode titles that are some doctrine names, and we're going to do a little bit more of the footwork. We'll pull out the context of when those were debated, why they were debated, how they come out. And then we'll do the thing here that I really want to do, which is lead up to Augsburg. And we can then show how those things then show up in the confessions.
Oh, yeah. You're going to get numbering of sacraments. You're going to get married to priests. You're going to get all of these, which are those two things, by the way, are tied together. You're going to get all those things.
Yeah. So we're going to pull out those issues. We're going to see how they connect from arguments, debates, councils in the early Reformation, and we're going to show how they show up in our confessions. I think it's going to be fun to do, because this gets us back to our roots of sort of doing Reformation historical theology and systematics all in one go. And thanks, Phil, for helping us introduce this topic. I'll put in the show notes a link to Phil's blog on the Leipzig debate, a link to my translation of Heidelberg Disputation. Is there anything, your article on Anselm?
Academy class on the Augsburg Confession. I go through a lot of these things.
I will put the Academy class to the Augsburg Confession there as well. And hopefully you find those resources a useful part of extended study if you want to go beyond these Lincoln Fellows episodes. As always, you can support the show by going to 1517.org/donate. You can also rate the show on Apple Podcasts, is, you know, the most popular platform where that helps, but also some podcasting apps are now introducing their own rating systems. And if you've noticed that there is that, whether you're using Spotify, Google, or Google Play Podcasts or something of that stripe, we'd appreciate a review there as well. All right, we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.